ॐ छत्रं कर्णे तिष्ठन्याम देवाः भद्रं पश्ये माक्षतेर्यछत्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैस्तिष्ठुवापुंसस्तनूभिः तिषेमदेवहितन्यतायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृत्तश्रवाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्तारक्षो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः Yad archimad yad anibhyo nicha Yad archimad yad anibhyo nicha Yasmin loka nihita lokinascha Yasmin loka nihita lokinascha Tiretat aksharam brahma Tiretat aksharam brahma Sapanaha Sapanaha Tarvatmanaha Tarvangmanaha Tere-tat-satyam, tad-amritam Tad-vedhavyam-saunya-viddhi Tad-vedhavyam-saunya-viddhi Here, Sandhi Yet Archimat Yet Anujjaha Anujja Yasmin Lokaha Nihitaha Lokinaha Cha Ted Eted Aksharam Brahma Sa Pranaha Tet U Vak Manaha Tet Etet Satyam Tet Amritam Tet Vedhavyam Sonia Siddhi. All of these are speaking of the nature of Brahman. It says, Yad Archimat, that which has luminosity, that which has consciousness. It's been inspired by Swamiji's Bhasha on this. It's not that there's some inert object, there's some inert Brahman that has consciousness. Because that mat affect shows possession of whatever the noun is. The noun is Archi, so luminosity or shining, self-shining. So Brahman has consciousness, but there's nothing else about Brahman that has the consciousness. That's, you have to understand how the mud is being used. We would say, Brahman, which is Sat, which is pure being, which is existence itself, that existence is consciousness. There's not something that has consciousness other than the consciousness. Like, for instance, if I could say, these pants, this fabric is blue. It has blueness, but the fabric is different than the blue. Right? Here, existence is not different than the consciousness, so that the consciousness is an attribute of existence. Existence being is consciousness. And to really understand what that means, you have to understand it in terms of your own self-experience. When you say, I am an existent being, you can't remove that from the consciousness. Right? You can't say, I am an existent being who has consciousness as an attribute. Another way to understand this, that the consciousness and the existence are one and the same thing, is that when you do the drit drisha viveka, the seer-seeing differentiation, anything that can be objectified is something which is illumined by consciousness. In other words, it comes and goes. Right? If there's a subject-object differentiation there. And by the mere fact that something exists within duality and can be differentiated, it means that that thing, by its nature, itself doesn't enjoy existence. It doesn't enjoy being itself. And the reason it doesn't enjoy being itself, anything that you can look at, is because it comes into existence and goes out of existence. But the best way to understand this is just to watch your mind. It comes into being, it goes out of being. Comes into existence and goes out of existence. On either side, there's non-existence. It's true of any object in the world. You can break it down infinitely, or you can just watch it change through time. But the fact is, anything that you experience, anything objectifiable, comes into existence and goes out of existence, and therefore is bordered by non-existence. It's just a simple fact of all experience, all objectifiable experience. That means that those things that you are experiencing themselves can't have existence. Right? If they had existence, they couldn't come in, they couldn't lose existence. But they start with non-existence and they end up with non-existence. Anything. Anything that comes into being and goes out of being. That means the existence that you experience is not something which is objectifiable. Which is not. None of you can say. You can say, look at the rug. Look at this face. Look at the wall. Look at this body. Look at these thoughts. Look at anything. You can say that about anything objectifiable. You can never say, look at existence. Look at existence. Consciousness, let consciousness illumine existence. No. Consciousness illumines names and forms. It illumines sense objects. Anything that can be objectifiable by the sense organs, that's what it illumines. Or it illumines the thoughts in the mind, the moods in the mind, the emotions in the mind, the memories. It illumines that. These things all come and go. All of these things that consciousness illumines enjoy existence while those things are there. Well, any given perception is there. That perception enjoys existence. So consciousness illumines, so look at this. Consciousness illumines the perception. Consciousness illumines the experience. And the experience exists as long as it is there. You see that? Once it's gone, it doesn't exist anymore. But it exists as long as it is there. Where does it get the existence? For you to be able to say that that thought, that experience is. Because a second ago it didn't exist, and in a second it's not going to exist. But while it's there, it exists. Can you look at the thought or the object and say, yes, it exists, I see some existence right there in it? No. You can never objectify existence. What it is that the consciousness that illumines the thought is what exists. It is the consciousness itself that exists. And so this will be your experience. Because consciousness itself is what exists, or you can say that it is consciousness that is existence, therefore, every single thought or perception or experience that you have is both known, because it's illumined by consciousness, it is known, and it is. Okay? Actually, it is known because consciousness illumines it. And it is because the consciousness that illumines it is. You get it? So your experience of isness is unvarying. It never changes in any way. It's not wobbly. The experiences that come and go are, of course, very wobbly. They come into being and they go out of being. They come into being and they go out of being. This experience and this experience and this experience and then this experience. But what never changes is the existence. Existence is the stable common denominator, which is the very non-objectifiable being that every experience that you have enjoys as its being. But when we say as its being, it's not that the thought or the perception has that being in and of itself. It's just that there is no other being except for that being. If we use the clay pot example, we can say that the pot has no being other than the clay at all. There is no pot, in fact. There is only clay. Like, exactly like that, where we can say the clay is independent of the pot is totally dependent on the clay. Like that, we say, in your experience right now, every experience that you have enjoys being. That is the very existence, the very substance of your experience. And it never varies at all. We think that that existence belongs to what we're perceiving.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it belongs to it in the same way that the clay belongs to the pot. Right? In that these things that you're perceiving have no being at all, away from the stable existence which is their substance. But that stable existence, which is their substance, is consciousness. Right? So look at it like this. In every single experience you have, without any exception and with no wavering whatsoever, everything is and is known. Right? Every experience you have, it is and it is known. The experiences go on changing, but what remains is known. So I can just say what remains is known. Is this the existence? Known is the consciousness. There is nothing but is known. Period. Take away all of the names and forms, all of the perceptions. What is left is known. Existence, consciousness. Existence, consciousness is what is. Everything else is just simply... Simply what? Everything else is simply what? That's a good question. Everything else is simply, we can say, is simply Maya, is simply knowledge. But in terms of being, what is this manifestation that we experience? In terms of the substance, the substance is that which is not objectifiable. And what is not objectifiable? Is existence itself in consciousness. You can't say existence which is consciousness. You can't say, look at that consciousness over there. Look at that existence. You can only be it. And it is its own experience. That's why Archimut. Brahman. It is Brahman that has the consciousness, nothing else. The conscious Brahman has the consciousness means Brahman is the consciousness. This doesn't have consciousness. This doesn't have consciousness. This body doesn't have consciousness. This sense organs don't have consciousness. Or you can say, well, yes, they do. I would say like this. This body is consciousness. These sense organs are consciousness. The mind is consciousness. The space is consciousness. The rug is consciousness. The wall is consciousness. If I can say the wall is consciousness, I can say this body is consciousness. If I can say the space is consciousness, I can say my sense organs are consciousness. But if I can't say everything is consciousness, right, then I better just say Brahman is consciousness. Because otherwise what will you say? Brahman is consciousness. Brahman is consciousness in the form of this mind. That's not going to be true. If I can say Brahman, let me put it this way. If I can say this mind is consciousness, because the mind is not away from consciousness any more than the pot is away from the clay, so if I could say, this mind is consciousness, my sense organs are consciousness, right? My sense perceptions are consciousness, whatever I perceive is consciousness, if I can say that, then that's fine. I can say all of this is nothing but consciousness. And this body, mind, sense organs are included in that. Yeah? The problem is that that's not what we do. Because we are a jiva, an individual, I mean this body, mind, sense organs, walking around through this creation, looking at it through our sense organs with a mind that's different from yours, which is true. My sense organs are different from your sense organs and yours. My mind is different from your mind. One thought is different from another thought. This body is different from this body. And so we're born into that, with that ignorance and into that ignorance. Right? And so looking around in the creation, the rug isn't conscious, the space isn't conscious, the wall isn't conscious, the table isn't conscious, my clothes aren't conscious, this body is conscious. Right? Because there's a subtle body abiding in this body that doesn't extend past into the space. I'll say this body is conscious because it's pervaded by my sense of touch. So this body is conscious. Right? But okay. Really analyze your experience. If you say this body is conscious because it's pervaded by my sense of touch, a dead body isn't conscious. Right? If I become a paraplegic, that wherever that break is from there down is not conscious. Right? So I need my sense of touch for this body to be conscious. So actually, when I say this body is conscious, what I mean really is that this body I am aware of through the sense of touch and through my sense of sight and through my sense of hearing. This table I'm aware of now through my sense of touch, through my sense of sight. Okay? You all I'm aware of through my sense of sight and sense of hearing. But the reality is, if we look at it that way, through my sense organs, I'm gaining a vritti, a thought modification, right? All of which is in consciousness. What I perceive through my sense of touch is in the thought modification. What I hear with my ears, what I see with my eyes, all of it is in the thought modification, which is known, which is, and which is known. Okay? So I am the knowledge, the conscious being, which is the very self of the whole. Right? But I need to be able to discriminate and differentiate myself from all of the things that I'm normally identified with, like the body and the mind and the sense organs, before I can recognize, in fact, that this body, mind, sense organs, and everything that makes me an individual separate from you is as much part of the whole as everything else. And if I'm looking at all of you, I take a picture, take a picture, there you all are in the picture. You are all part of the scenery. But guess who's left out of the picture? Right? I'm always, this upadhi, and I'm witnessing all of you, I'm the seer. I'm the subject, witnessing you, the object. And so I can see all of you as part of the creation. I very rarely include this body and mind and sense organs as part of the creation. I can easily say, your body and your mind and your sense organs and your thoughts and your emotions, they're all part of one whole. They're all part of Ishvara. They're all part of one vast network, one vast manifestation of an infinite creation. And all of you are included in it. And all of you I can see now, all of you are included in it, and all of you are so nicely in my awareness. Because I am having a thought modification right now through my sense of sight that includes all of you. Right? So all of you are equally in my awareness. And I would say, that wall is in my awareness, and you're in my awareness, and the space is in my awareness, and all of that. And then I usually stop there. But what if I don't stop there? Or what if you're talking? Because you could equally say, you're forgetting to include yourself, because from my vantage point, you're also part of this infinite creation. And that, in fact, is the reality. These are all what we call drishyas. They are all objects of perception. They're all objectifiable. They all are part of Ishvara. They're all part of the total manifestation of this creation. Nobody is separate from it at all. And all are objectifiable entities within that whole. Who is not the objectifiable entity within the whole? Who is not? Who is not objectifiable? Only me. And who is that me? The one who can't, the self, the conscious being that cannot be objectified. The consciousness that you can't look at. The existence that you cannot look at. That's the subject. That's the subject. How many are there? Anything that is objectifiable is not the subject. it's not the subject for you, and it's not the subject for me. Because it's objectifiable, and it's the subject cannot be objectifiable. You know what I mean by objectifiable? It means making it into an object that you're aware of. There's only one thing that cannot be objectified, and that is consciousness itself, awareness itself, being itself. And who am I? Am I the object that's illumined, or am I the conscious being? Everyone, whether they have knowledge or not, says, I am conscious. If you have to describe yourself, well, I'm a conscious being. That's who I am. I'm the one who illumines all my experience. I am the one who is present to all experience. And I ask, well, can you illumine yourself? Well, if you've been taught, you will say, probably answer, well, I am self-luminous, but of course I can't illumine myself as an object. But because I am consciousness, I am known, not as an object, but just like the sun doesn't need another luminary to light it up, I don't need another luminary to light myself up. I am the conscious being. And so this Brahman, why is this Atma, who is the conscious being, Arachimat, who has consciousness, called Brahman? You are Brahman. Why does the Atma gain the stature of being Brahman? Because the Atma, the self that you are, is not objectifiable. You can't look at yourself. You can only be yourself. You are your own experience. Since you're not objectifiable, there can't be two of you. Because you're not going to exist as an object in space. So there can't be two of you. And the existence that is here is only one. The existence that is here is only one, because if the existence belonged to anything here, it would go into non-existence. Existence can't go into non-existence. So the experience of existence, which this entire creation enjoys, is the nature of your being. And so the very being that is called Brahman, because it is infinite, because there is no other being. We wouldn't call Atma Brahman. We wouldn't call the conscious being that you are Brahman if there was another being, because then it wouldn't be infinite. For something to be infinite, there is not room for another thing. So we're not talking about numerically infinite. When numerically infinite, then when we're numbers, we're in the creation, then and nothing exists, because everything comes and goes. Nothing has real existence. When Brahman, which is said to be infinite, which is the meaning of Brahman, then that one thing, which is conscious existence, is infinite, then where is there room for another thing? Because if there was another thing, then you would have two, and both would limit the other. So when we say you, the Atma, the self, is Brahman, you say you are one without a second. There's not room for another thing. And so this Brahman is called Arachimat, that which is Arachimat, that which is consciousness, that which is self-luminous. And then he says, this is very famous and occurs in other Upanishads also, Yad Anu Jaha Anuhu. Yad Anu. Anu means that which is subtle. The subtler than subtle. Subtle than the subtle. The most subtle. Smaller than the smallest. Because, this is the idea here. Imagine this creation. Here it is. You have to imagine it. And think of this creation. Think of the smallest item. Atom or quark, the smallest item imaginable or conceivable in the creation. Does that item exist? Is it known? Yes. It is, and it is known. The being of the smallest imaginable item, right, is Brahman. So Brahman is more subtle or smaller than the smallest. Because the very being of the smallest imaginable item is Brahman. Now imagine when they have the cha here, because it says, Anubhyaha Anucha, Cha brings in the reverse, the larger than the largest. Larger than the largest. Imagine now the entire creation, the infinite creation of multidimensional, the infinite creation. Does it exist?
Yes.
Is it known?
Yes.
That is Brahman. So the one that, and another example is a little bit different, but say if there, I think it's Ketu Upanishad that uses this, if you send your mind to the moon, send your mind to the moon, as soon as your mind gets there, it's known. Right? Wherever the mind goes, that is known. If you imagine the entire infinite creation, it is known. It is and it is known. This is important. When our vice saying now is known, the isness is given to the creation, the knownness is given to the creation. Because consciousness is existence. It is conscious. Look, this kind of language. Consciousness, your being, is what exists. It's not like there's an existence outside. It is your being, consciousness, which is. There is nothing else that is. So consciousness is called existence because it is consciousness which is. It's not existence over here or consciousness that has existence. It is consciousness that is. And so that the beingness of consciousness is what the whole creation enjoys. So you imagine the whole creation, Brahman is already there as its being. You imagine the smallest part of the creation, Brahman is already there as its being. Because yourself, your being, has no size itself. What size is Brahman? It's another problem. We think of Brahman and infinite, or Atma. We say Atma is infinite. Then we always think in terms of size. It's infinitely large, because the creation is infinitely large. Space is of infinite dimension. And of course, wherever space is, Brahman is. Wherever the smallest item is, Brahman is. But then, does that mean that Brahman is infinitely large or infinitely small? If it has size, right, then it's within duality. It has a right side and a left side, and a top and a bottom. And you don't experience your being as being having a top or a bottom or a right side or a left side. You experience your body as having a right side or a left side, a top and a bottom. If you have a thought, you can see, well, what's at the top of the thought? Say if I ask you to imagine a meadow. So you're imagining the meadow. Well, on the top there's the sky, and on the bottom there's the ground and the shrubs, and on the left side there's some trees, and on the right side there's a lake. So you can imagine top, bottom, left, right, middle. But all of that has to do with duality, with dimension, not with awareness. If you think of awareness, of the right side of awareness and the left side of awareness, what's in between awareness? And where is the spatial dimension there? The spatial dimension belongs to the creation. Think like this. If I ask you to have an imagination, or you have a dream at night, say for instance, the space, air, fire, water, earth, the elements of the dream come with the dream. The dimension comes with the dream. The dimension comes with your imagination. The dimension comes with your perception. Right, so all of dimension exists within the creation. If you collapse the creation, right, like when you wake up from the dream, where's the dimension gone? You know, in reference to the dream, you dream, dimension comes, you wake up, dimension goes, in reference to that dream. But there's no dimension in reference to you, to me. When you say I, me, what dimension is there? It's totally irrelevant. What color are you? What color is awareness? Brown, yellow, white. Your skin might be brown or yellow or white. Blonde. Awareness is blonde.
And blue eyes.
How tall is awareness? Me. Absolutely irrelevant. These words don't apply. Now, even once you start getting used to your own nature, you can say, is awareness happy? Is it sad? These emotions that belong to the mind also don't apply. Ananda that we focused on in the meditation as wholeness or fullness, these are not objective terms that can be objectified. You can think of the mind having various states of happiness. Those are states that belong to the mind. They come and go. But is the happiness that belongs to the mind the ananda of the self? No. Is the unhappiness that belongs to the mind the unhappiness of the self? No. What is the nature, the self-experience is unique to you, to the self itself. So even that ananda, you know, when we think of emotions, they don't define me. I am the one who has emotions. I am the one who is sad, who is happy, who is agitated. This I is different than all of that. They don't apply. So this is the one that needs to be recognized. So this one that is free from dimension, not large, not small, not a color, not an emotion, not something objectifiable, just my being, the conscious being that I am. This one, it is in this one, yasmin lokaha nihita lokinascha. Lokinahacha says, it's in this Atma, this me, that this entire universe, all of the worlds, are. The entire universe, all the lokas, they say lokas in plural, to count for all of the different dimensions, all of the different heaven worlds, all of the different hell worlds, this particular loka, there's many, many, in India they acknowledge many different dimensions of the creation. Say when the jiva transmigrates due to your punya papa, there's many different dimensions of experience. So if we look at this universe, we'll look at many, many different dimensions of experience that make up this universe. The entire universe itself, all of it, rests only in this, has this Brahman, this self, for its being. And not only the entire infinite universe, all of the lokas, all of the different dimensions, lokinaha, all of the individuals also. All of the lokas, all of the worlds, and all of the individuals in the world, all of the beings in the world. You think of it like this. You have a dream at night, and this dream that you're having, that is a loka, that's a world. Now that world is in you, right? It's your dream. That entire world is in you. It has you for its being. But not only does that whole world have you, that loka, have you for its being, that's all rooted in you, all of the beings in that dream are rooted in you, including one that you may be falsely identified with. Right? You have the whole dream is in you, all of the beings are in you, including the one you may be identified with, looking out at the dream through the sense organs of that dream character. All of the dream characters in the entire dream are in you. So here it's not dream. This entire infinite universe, all of the different spheres of existence, all of the different worlds, they are in you. And all of the beings in those worlds, all of them, all of the devatas, all of the rakshasas, all of the humans, all of the ants, all the mice, all the creatures, all the plants, all living entities, and all inert entities. The entire infinite creation and all beings in the creation, all of them are in you alone. Yes, man means in which. Because it's that which is pure consciousness, arachimat. That which is smaller than the smallest and bigger than the biggest. Right? Then that which is that in which all of the worlds and all of the individuals and all the beings in the world are located. Tereetet Aksharam Brahma. That is this Aksharam, changeless, non-destructible Brahman. That is the Aksharam Brahman. That in that which is consciousness. That in which all of this is. Tereetet Aksharam Brahma. And that Brahman, which is all of this, that is prana. That is your breath. That is your speech. That is your mind. It's really beautiful. Mm. We tend to remove ourselves, what makes me me as an individual, from all of the world and all of the beings. No, your very breath. Your very breath is Brahman. It looks like this. Look at it like this. The breath itself is not away from consciousness. Right? The breath comes and goes in consciousness. The breath exists. Right? The breath exists. The breath is known. The very being of the breath. I mean the breath. The breath, the very being of the breath itself is consciousness. Speech, your intelligence, your speech, the speech itself is Brahman. There's nothing in the speech that is away from consciousness that doesn't exist. Your mind is Brahman. Is the mind known? Is the mind conscious? Yes. The speech is. The speech is a manifestation of intelligence, but are you aware of your speech? Yes. Are you aware of your mind? Yes. Does your mind exist? Yes. Does your speech exist? Yes. Does your breath exist? Yes. Can you think of it like this? When you have a dream, the dream characters have minds. Are the minds Brahman? Do the minds themselves, are they away from the self? The whole world is in the self, right? The whole dream world is in the self. The dream bodies are in the self. What about the dream minds? Are they part of the dream creation? Are they part of the self? Do they have the self as their being? What about the dream speech? Are the dream characters breathing? What about the dream characters' breath? So what you take to give you life, right? You take your breath to give you life. But is the breath separate or other than Brahman? Is the breath, what the very breath itself, separate from the total laws and manifestation of the creation? So when you objectify, when you see what is the essence of your being, of your mind, the manas, the vak, the speech, the ingoing and outgoing breath, is that also not pervaded by your presence? Is your being, the conscious being that you are, also not the very center of that? Does that not also come and go in consciousness? Does consciousness not also pervade that? So he says, that is the Aksharam Brahman, and that is your prana, that is your breath, that is the mind, that is the manas. Tereetet Satyam. It is that which is real. It is that which is the reality. He said that at the very beginning. Tereetet Satyam. This is what is true. This is what is real. By true, by Satyam here, means this Brahman is what actually is. That's Satyam. That which cannot be negated in past, present, or future. that which actually is here in this creation, the very clay of the pot, that which is actually here, but you are actually the very being of what is here, that is Brahman, that is the reality. And tad amritam, and that is immortal. Immortal means there is no death. For that Brahman which you are, there is no change, there is no death. And what is that? It's the very conscious being that I am, that is present. The very conscious being that is present to the mind, to the sense organs, to the body, to perception. There's nothing in fact here that isn't Brahman. This whole thing is Brahman. Just like you can say the whole play, pot is nothing but clay. We say this whole creation is Brahman. It's nothing but Brahman. You understand that there is nothing here but Brahman. How are you going to have an experience of Brahman? Other than what is? If nothing here is anything but Brahman, like talking about the entire universe, then there's nothing here but Brahman. In the same way that there's for the clay pot, there's nothing here but clay, how can you have an experience of Brahman? It'd be more true to say, how can you not have an experience of Brahman because there is no place where Brahman is not? So there's not any way to not have an experience of Brahman. Let's put it this way. There's no way to have an experience of Brahman other than to be Brahman, because there is no other thing than Brahman. So to be able to recognize aham brahmasmi, I am Brahman, you have to be able to recognize what is here right now is Brahman. All of it. And so if all of it, what is actually here right now is Brahman, you can't say that this cloth is Brahman and the chair is Brahman, unless you can say that the cloth and the chair is Brahman. You can say the cloth, the chair, the table, the space, my body, my sense organs, my mind, right, my emotions, all of them are Brahman. You have to be able to say that. If you can say that, then you have to be able to recognize what is exactly the same in the chair, and in the cloth, and in the table, and in the space, and in my sense organs. What I'm saying though, look, if you say that the only thing here is Brahman, and Brahman is consciousness, which is existence, you have to be able to recognize that is the common denominator. That is the common denominator. That is never, if that's all there is, if that is the truth of everything, that is the one thing you can never ever be away from, no matter what the experience. All of these experiences and all the objects that you experience are infinitely divisible. You can't find an object here. You can't find an object. Because all objects that come and go, and they all can be dissected into smaller and smaller objects, but always left is Brahman. The smaller you go, the bigger you go, it doesn't make any difference. What is there is Brahman. It's the being that never changes. See, you should walk around and say, okay, what never changes? In all my experience, what is always there, immutable, absolutely immutable, that is Brahman. And that is not going to be an object you look at, it is going to be who you are. It's just that we have the mind, which is limited and located in this body, so to speak, has usurped from me and said, the mind has said, I am me. Whereas in fact, I am all of this. There is no me contained. There is no contained me. But the mind is contained. The mind is a shape, you know, it's limited. And it is Brahman, but because of ignorance, the mind says, I am Brahman. It should be able to say that, like if the pot could say, you know, I am clay, but know that the clay is free from it, that would be great. The mind can say, I am Brahman. That's true. But then it has to be able to say, and Brahman is free from me. I am Brahman, and Brahman is free from me. The pot can say, I am the clay, and the clay is free from me. Or I can say, my mind can say, I am Brahman, my body is Brahman, the space is Brahman, you are Brahman, everything is Brahman, there is only Brahman. And that's perfect. But the mind has ignorance, and so it says, I am Brahman. And I will be alive as long as the body is alive. And my mind is smart, but it's not as smart as yours, and it is smarter than yours. On and on and on, and division, 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 division. That's the ignorance, right? The mind is Brahman, but the body is Brahman, the space is Brahman, everything is Brahman. But it's important to realize, if you say, if you understand the mind is Brahman, then there is no consciousness. There is no other consciousness we're looking for. I say the body is Brahman. Right. That's right. That's why I can take myself to be the body. Right? Because myself is the self of the body. Myself is the self of the mind. It is the self of the creation. The difference is, the thing that we don't realize is this self that I am is the self of all. And it never changes in any way. And you've never experienced it as changing. You just haven't recognized that fact. Because the adjusta, the superimposition, is so much that you actually have never experienced any change in yourself at all at any time. You have always been the stable one, present to all the changing experiences. But when you take yourself to be a changing experience, then you think you're changing. But that's not your experience. Your experience is that you are the changeless, constant being, present and pervasive to all experience that you have. That is your experience. You just have to recognize it. That ignorance has to be removed. So, tad vedavyam. The mind has to get this. It has to land on this. Tad vedavyam. It has to land on this. Hey, Soumya. Hey, beloved, beloved student. My beloved student, Soumya. Vidhi. Know this. Understand this. Very beautiful. Okay, let's take a minute.
The body is consciousness. Can I say it says I am consciousness?
Your mind says I am consciousness.
Yes.
And your mind says the body is consciousness.
Yes.
And you're right.
Yeah. Well, where am I wrong there?
You're wrong unless you can say the body is consciousness, the mind is consciousness, my sense organs are consciousness,
yeah.
And you are consciousness, and the space is consciousness, and the chair is consciousness. Then if you can, that means that you recognize that, in fact, the consciousness that this body enjoys is the consciousness in which the whole universe enjoys. And then the Dehatma Buddhi is broken. That's the thing. But what's so important about that understanding is we tend to think that, like for now, say if you say, I am the body, there's something very true about that. Because the consciousness, existence, which the body enjoys is Brahman. There is no other consciousness. But you have to be able to say, I am the body, is the same clay pot understanding, where the body enjoys consciousness, but consciousness is free of the body. Mm-hmm. You have to understand that.
Mm-hmm.
But the consciousness, when the mind says, I am the conscious being, it's owning Brahman. Right? There is no other conscious being there, and there's no distance between consciousness and the mind. But the mind, that's the maya, the mind is something that has no substance apart from consciousness, but it comes and goes. That's maya. Best way that I think to understand maya is to just look at your mind. The mind that can have a dream, the mind that can have imagination. That stuff is what we call Maya, and it has no independent substance. You know, there's nothing there really but consciousness. If you were to look for something, you know, some substance, there's no substance there but consciousness. It's only consciousness. But here it is. Here's the solid. This is nothing but consciousness, but there you are, and you are, and you are. That's what we call Maya. That which has no other being, separate being.
So if there comes a time when the mind is not in consciousness, when the mind changes or...
No, like a thought. When I use an example like that, say if you have a thought comes in your mind. Right now I ask you to think of an apple. The apple thought has come, and now I say think of a pear. The apple thought is gone. Right? So like that, in fact, every experience that you have that's objectifiable comes and goes. But they all come and change. Even a material object itself, you know, can be come and go. It has a beginning, it has an end. You know, it goes through this these vikaras, you know, through time. It comes into existence, it becomes old, dies, goes out of existence. Or I can shred it into smaller and smaller parts, shred it infinitely. Just destructible. Right. Any object that exists within space that's subject to time is destructible. It's a beginning and an end. Consciousness doesn't have a beginning and an end. It's not destructible. That means the being that you are, the me, the one who says I am the body, that I is indestructible. That consciousness that you are is not destructible. It's amritam. It's not subject to death. It's not subject to change. It's not an object to be bound by samsara, to be bound by birth and death and change. It's timeless. And you actually experience yourself as timeless. That's why you can't understand how you could die. You can't possibly understand it because you can't die. There's no death for you. There's no such thing. Because the Atma is not an object subject to time and space. So yourself doesn't die. Yourself is in fact the very substance of all that is. And you think, well, that's not very personal. Well, there is nothing impersonal. Let's put it that way. You say, oh, that's not personal. Well, what does that mean? I would say there is nothing impersonal. The only thing that there is personal. It is yourself. Yourself is personal. Oh, by personal means my body. Well, is your body responsible for the self-experience? I would say your body has absolutely nothing to do with the self-experience.
Huh.
Like this. Is the pot responsible for the clay experience? Does the pot contribute to the clay experience at all? It has nothing to do with it. The clay experience is the clay experience. So your self-experience is your self-experience. It has nothing to do with the name and form at all. It is totally, totally independent of name and form. And is it personal? Well, it is personal because it's you. And just because there's only one of me doesn't mean that it's impersonal. Do you see what I mean? I am personal. Whether there be one me or a billion me's, as long as it's me, it's personal. But this happens to be one self, and that one self is personal because it's me.
So this sense of being personal, it's not doesn't originate from body and mind, but it's from my own
being. That's right.
Because I do feel it
very personal.
Yeah.
And in fact, this is important because you feel it so personal, you think, oh, so they're not talking about me. Because it's so personal that you think this is me, or it is you. But that me is Brahman. That me that is so personal is Brahman, not another me. So you should look for the most personal me. And then focus on that one. That, oh, this personal me? That was my greatest revelation. I'll never forget it. When I was in India at the first course there in the 70s and walking down the pathway, me? I just was, me? You're talking about me. This me. I couldn't believe it. And then I would still remember turning my voice. Does this me go away? Can I make it change? This personal me. You look and see. It's the personal me that you take to be you right now. Can you in any way get rid of that personal self? Look at when you have a negative thought, positive thought. When whatever the thought may be, you can meditate on non-existence. You can try to put a bag over, try to go there and try to shake it up or something. You cannot do anything. You cannot do anything. It is never not there. So you have to come home. You have to ground this knowledge from these flights of impersonal fancy, the impersonal infinite. You know, Brahman is the impersonal infinite. Who wants that? It has no appeal. It has no appeal at all. But it's also not true. It has no appeal because it's not true. It's tattvamasi, that thou art, you are that. The student goes to the teacher, not saying, is there some infinite Brahman for me to have an experience of? In the Upanishad, the student does not go to the teacher with that. Is there anything about me that survives death? What about me survives death? Who am I? Who am I? Oh, you're some infinite Brahman that you have to go and have some kind of experience of, and when you do, yourself will be dead. When you do, you will merge. Right? Your ego will be annihilated. You will be annihilated. In that moment of annihilation, you will recognize the infinite and impersonal, spatially huge Brahman. It has nothing to do with the Upanishads. It's not at all what they're talking about. It's talking about you. Yourself, which is the only being that is there. It's not big, it's not large. It's the only being that is there. It's not an object for it to be a size. So who is that self? You have to see. Ananda. Ananda makes it personal. It's not that Ananda makes it personal, but the understanding of that to try to ground you into that which is about you, that which is the most dear, the most beloved. You know? What matters the most to you about yourself? Then see if you can get rid of it. Because anything that is objectifiable, you can dismiss. You can remove that from your experience. Anything objectifiable can be removed from your experience. You know? But you can never remove yourself from your experience.
Well, my only, kind of flickering doubt about that is that, when I think about unconsciousness, I see sleep and imagine death as to be something like that.
The thing is with that, when the mind is asleep, it goes through three states of experience, many states, but you can divide them into the three. You've got your waking state, which means that your mind, this is how we differentiate. Waking state means your mind is using the sense organs. It's engaging the sense organs to experience this world. That's the waking state. The dream state is when the mind is awake, but it's not engaging the sense organs. So even you can have daydreams, right, where the sense organs are not in operation. They're not being used. That's the dream state. The deep sleep state is when the mind itself is in its causal condition. It's not functioning. It's not that it's not there, right? It's just in its causal condition. And so at that time, there's no thought modifications taking place. So there's no perception of duality. There's not even the ahankara saying, oh, look, I'm deep sleeping. There's no cognition of time, right? There's no cognition of space. Unless the mind is what we call just partially asleep, so that you're tracking time a little bit because there's a partial cognition of your body. Right? So then you have some very subtle awareness of time and deep sleep. But when you're really in deep sleep fully, there is no tracking of time. You can shut your eyes and open your eyes, and there's no tracking of time. So you're really deeply unconscious or in very deep sleep. Okay? When that is the case, there's no marking of time. You see that? There's no marking of time. So there's no before and after. Right? Mm-hmm. And so in terms of your being, there isn't even a flicker. There can't be a flicker. The awareness that illumines this unconscious state, first of all, is illumining that state. And so we say that when you wake up, you will have memory, right? Because the mind is still there. It's just in causal condition, which we call unmanifest or objective condition. But then when you wake up and the mind is awake and now chit-chatting away and the memory is functioning and all that, then you can describe that condition, right? So all along, consciousness was there, awareness was there, being was there, but the mind was in causal condition, right? So no chit-chatting at that time, nothing functioning. The mind is up, right? And then it will describe that condition, which I've just done, right? And everybody goes, yeah, that's what happens in deep sleep, you know, there's no time, there's no space, there's no activity, right? There's not any eye thought. There's just a sukha of fullness. And you say that because when you wake up, you want to go back. Like, so people enjoy that. Which speaks to the ananda, in fact, that the mind loves to go to sleep and blot out the whole universe. Doesn't even care. Doesn't even want the ahankara there. Doesn't want anything there. Just, oh, great. Okay. Let me just knock everything off completely. You know. So Swamiji sometimes he jokes and says, you know, the partial ignorance is really a problem, you know. But in deep sleep, there's total ignorance. Your being, you know, and a mind which is there in causal condition, right? Mm. But not problematic. Mm.
I've been doing more and more of that lately.
Because it's the lazy man samadhi. Don't worry about knowledge or anything, just go to sleep.
Yeah.
But do you see the logic there, Hal?
Yeah, I do. I think there's some, you know, kind of like habitual, you know, kind of an identification with consciousness as consciousness differentiation as being the self.
You always think, yes, of consciousness as a knower.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Consciousness is not a knower. Yeah. It's consciousness. Mm-hmm. And your own presence. That's another beautiful thing in meditation or doing japa. Just have your mind ask yourself, okay, am I, a conscious being, knowing anything? You see, no. You're just a conscious being. Everything that comes in front of you is known, but you're not performing an act of knowing. That's why the consciousness that I am is the consciousness that you are, right? I don't know what you're knowing because my mind is different from your mind. But the consciousness is not performing an act of knowing.
So the knownness is exactly the same.
The knownness is exactly the same. The knownness is not an act. The self isn't going around knowing this or knowing that. Even right now, if you focus just on your presence, you're not performing, all of this is known, but it's known because there's a mind and sense organs here, that your being is not performing an act. You just simply are. Yeah. So, now the Upanishad is going to go into the next, we'll do the next two verses next time. Om. Meditation on Om. And an unfoldment on the meaning of Om. It's very, very nice. Beautiful. So we'll be talking about Om.
Ambition and ideas of achievement seem to drop away and less attached or just more moment. But there's also a deep love for what I do or what I want to be in my life. But it feels like it's just a love, like a passion and a love. Is that Brahman? I mean, is that just...
It's the power of the karma. Because when you take this verse, so you can even have ambition and energy and wanting to accomplish this or come, all of that can be there. It's just what isn't there is you can have the ambition and the drive to do something that can be your karma, what you're born to do here. But what you don't have is, I have to do this in order to be happy. So you're freed of that. You know, that part, I need this so that I can be happy. The so that I can be happy part isn't there. So you have the ambition and the drive and the energy and the wanting to learn this or achieve that as all part. It's just a natural expression of the upadhi, of the power of the karma. You know, and you watch that unfold. One, my Buddhist at least in my life, I'll be very, very, I like to study, but I'll study something intensely for several years, be totally involved in it until I'm not, and then because organically and naturally it'll move in, my life will move slowly to something else, and then I'm very engaged and involved in that. And that's just the unfoldment of the karma in your interests also. So there's nothing wrong with drive or ambition or energy or love for different subject matters. You know, that's life. That's the upadhi. Living out the life that, you know.
Yeah, is that how you can see Swamiji? Because he has so many great qualities and has done so much and has such a big drive to help India now and to... Before it was to teach, that's part of it.
Yeah, and for him, what he'll say is, you can't believe that this is coming at this late age. Yeah, this kind of this, all of this energy to do this aim for seva requires so much energy and, you know, so much commitment and taking on. I can't believe this is coming at this age.
So much fun.
But at the same time, for you also, that drive and energy to do this and do that, that comes with the upadhi. It's not like all of a sudden yourself has changed to become you. Yourself is just yourself. It's always the same. You know, but then the body has energy, the mind has energy to get, you know, to focus on the things that you're meant to achieve. And another thing is your mind, as you gain nishta in your knowledge, the things that don't belong to you, you don't follow. Like, you know, when you see a samsari, a person who doesn't have knowledge, or a joke we often say, even in in common parlance, we'll say, you know, he wants to be like the Joneses or Mrs. Smith has this, so we should have that deer, you know. They have a nice White House and a picket fence, so we need the White House too without picket fence. Because they seem to be happy, and so if we have that, we'll also be happy. You know? Et cetera, it goes on and on and on. That kind of stuff falls off because that's just ignorance. You don't even you don't even have the attachment to your own prarabdha, let alone somebody else's. But the great thing is that your prarabdha is yours, and it unfolds as it's supposed to. And you develop a trust in that, a joy and a trust that nobody can take your own karma away from you. It's yours, you know. Yeah, for better or for worse.
We're all stuck with it.
The good and the bad, but it is yours. And so when things seem scary, usually because you're projecting the future about what horrible things could happen to you, you can learn, in fact, to just relax and see what does happen, actually. Kind of appreciate how Ishwara operates. It's very hard when you project into the future, a future that's not here yet. You project your fears, what could go wrong, or what terrible thing could happen to hurt you, and all of this type of thing. It's all, you're just out there in la-la land. It's not based in any type of actual reality. And so if you pull your mind back and say, well, let me just see how Ishwara takes care of it. And let me deal with things as if you're present, your mind will relax. It's good to pull the mind back from these projections into the future. And say, we'll take care of it. Pull it back, we'll take care of it. When the time comes, you'll be able to make, you can talk to your mind like that. When that time comes, we can make those decisions. We can see when the time comes. But now, let's deal with the present. Very helpful. You get into a lot of pain over nothing. Over future projections. And it's a relief to the mind when you realize that and pull it back. So let's see how Ishwara handles that.
So then on the flip side of that, it's okay to wonder about what you might do or think about it or get excited about the possibilities, if that's okay.
Absolutely. But it's one thing to get excited and look at all of the possibilities and take whatever actions are in the present to make those happen because you have energy in that way. But what if you get excited about the possibilities and then start worrying? But this might not happen, you know, then that could happen, and then that can, you create a whole web for yourself. That's what's problematic. If it's not causing pain, it's just fun, then. We tend to get trapped because we think, you see, well, yeah, to go that way and that way, and that would be great, and that would be wonderful, that would be so much fun, oh, I'd be so happy if that happened. Yeah, but then that could happen. You know? Mm-hmm. And then when your mind starts doing that, you say, okay, just wait a minute, calm down. We'll take it one step at a time. Mm-hmm.